Hello, my name is Arham Alam, and this is Swamp Talk, where you swamp the talk and talk the swamp. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Amy Coker, who is a physician at WellStar North Fulton. Dr. Coker, thank you so much for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
Okay, so I'm gonna first just go start with some questions. So, what is the current state of the pandemic?
So, good question. So, just so everybody knows, I'm an emergency physician at WellStar North Fulton Hospital. I've been there for about 7 years, and I, by no chance, am I expert or an epidemiologist or an infectious disease specialist, but I can just speak from my personal experiences on the job. So I would say that, we've had this ebb and flow since March, and it seemed like we have a big peak for a while, and then we had, personal physicians are like, oh, it looks like there's a lull coming down, and then again we had a big peak. And now I feel like on a daily basis it's almost similar to what I'd say like a flu season,
I
that there's
see.
some days that have no cases at all, and other days we have, three or four per physician.
Okay. So how have doctors been able to deal with the coronavirus and I guess these waves?
I think every day is, a new day. So when you walk into work, everybody has the option for PPE. As we've been progressing through the pandemic, we've gone from being told not to wear masks because it can freak people out to being mandated to have surgical masks on. And now we're mandated to have surgical masks on for the entire shift with N95 with the scary patients, with the suspected COVID patients.
I
And we
see.
always have to wear a face, like a face shield or eye protection. So that just personally, that's just going through months and just changing our practice.
Okay. So has the hospital experienced any shortages in like ventilators or masks during the pandemic?
So we had one weekend specifically, I can remember, about a month ago, that we only had two ventilators left. And we also have something called Vapotherm, or like this high flow nasal cannula, that helps to support people that don't need full ventilator support. And we were running low. We only had, I think, one left of those. And as a general idea, we're trying not to do what they call BiPAP, which is kind of a non-invasive way to provide oxygen support, because it can aerosolize the, in theory, aerosolize the virus. So we were kind of limited though on the ventilators. But apart from that, we have had to switch out gloves, so gloves that aren't as necessarily our favorites, or the gowns. There were probably a week where we were like pretty darn short on gowns, that we had to switch to almost like the surgical gowns, which are plastic and, the non-ideal stuff. But I don't think there's a day that we went with nothing, if that makes sense.
I see. Okay. Yeah, that definitely does make sense. So I want to shift gears for a moment. I would like to talk about statistics during the pandemic. I think particularly from a perspective, from a layman's perspective, if you will, statistics have proven helpful in understanding the pandemic better. So I just wanted to understand your perspective of it. How can or how has statistics and data collection proven to be useful for tracking COVID-19?
Well, I think a couple of things, and you can take this from different perspectives or different ways. I think ideally, there's some things that could be very helpful for us. One is to know things like if they could figure out the recurrence rate, like the likelihood of somebody getting it a second time. Because we do find ourselves in a pickle when there's a patient who comes in, is pretty sick, has to be hospitalized a couple of weeks, they go home, and they're feeling pretty good for a few weeks, and then they come back. I'm like, oh goodness, is this a recurrence, or is this the same thing twice? Or, so to get some more data collection on, that, especially even from China, some of the places that, had it initially, who are now kind of looking back retrospectively on what they see, that could be very helpful. Also, just knowing when to see your numbers are helpful. If we have an idea, we can better prepare. There was a time where we were thought we were going to need our tent outside, but thankfully that was not even necessary. We were able to how, you know, take care of the capacity in actually inside. So that was helpful. And I think other things, death rates in general, I mean, that's, I feel like that's a little bit hairy and people code it differently. It all depends on the physician and how they want to say what the initial cause of death was. So that data collection is not so at least helpful from an emergency medicine standpoint.
I see. So some people have said in the past that there have been that too many doctors have been pinning people's deaths on the coronavirus. Do you believe that that idea is grounded in fact, or is there more to it?
Well, yeah, there was that one, I think a scam that people were saying, oh, no, the actual total deaths is like only in the hundreds, and that's completely ridiculous. Because, yes, people are not dying of hypertension. They're dying of coronavirus and happen to have had hypertension potentially. So I do think that the death toll is as high as it's says, you know, most of these people, true, they're super frail, and even something as simple as flu, which, you know, flu kills lots of people every year.
Yes.
You know, even something as simple as that, I shouldn't say simple, but something like that would also lead to somebody's death, and it's these frail people that could have lived another year, but because they got COVID, it certainly was because of that. So I don't think they're padded like the media at what point said it is.
I see. So next, I would actually like to talk about a little bit about vaccines, just a little bit. I know you explained that you're not an infectious disease specialist, but I would like to gain some your perspective on it. So obviously, we're hoping to see a vaccine sometime soon. What do you believe What will you expect once that vaccine is made available?
Sure. And there's, you know, at one point there were around 100 vaccines in clinical trials. Obviously, most of them are early on. There were, you know, 5 or 6 more robust ones that were near the end of their in the studies. And to be clear, I think most of the red tape is removed. And so the whole rapidly trying to get there is not necessarily removing the safety aspect. It's more removing a lot of the red tape that's supposed to get there. So I do think that we'll get to a vaccine pretty quickly. There was one recently in trial that, you know, takes healthy people. They give different doses of the vaccine because that's part of it, trying to figure out the dose. You know, maybe one person gets one shot in the arm, then 2 shots in the arm, and 2 shots in both arms to decide who has symptoms. This specific trial I'm thinking of, they did have a high percentage of people that end up getting a fever in the short term or had other local discomfort and whatnot, different side effects. And this was not even an efficacy trial, so it didn't even say if it was going to be effective or just showing that there were not any significantly bad reactions and decide which. You know, they did trend their immunologic response to it, and they were very good, which is encouraging. And the side effects, albeit you get a fever, that's kind of stinks, but they weren't terrible. So I think that they're moving forward. I do think once we finally get a vaccine, I think everybody knows this, you have to ramp it up in actual production. So you have to get the vaccine, say it works, say it's safe, figure out the dose. And then you have to say, okay, now we have it. We have to ramp up production and then distribution. And then decide who gets the first doses. And almost certain it'll go to, you know, the people in the nursing home and the frontline workers and things like that first before they get to increase it. So I would like to think we'd have something by the end of the year, but and we may, as far as how quickly it'll be distributed to people, I don't know.
Okay, I see. Now, at your hospital, what type of treatments have y'all been using for COVID-19 patients?
So from an outpatient standpoint, there's nothing that's really been FDA approved for the coronavirus. So it's generally supportive care. When you're admitted and you have oxygen requirements, for instance, then they move on to things like dexamethasone or Decadron, which is a steroid, and that's been pretty standardized. Other things that are now deemed the standard of care, depending on the certain specific patient population and such, would be the convalescent plasma, mm-hmm. which is a plasma taken from a person who's already had COVID and taken essentially their antibodies in there, so you can get this passive immunity to the patient. And then also remdesivir, which is the antiviral, which is it's an IV medicine. It's pretty expensive. It's twice a day for 5 days right now. And they've done different studies to try to figure out the risk for up to 10 days and such. And I think the general idea is the best they can do is 5 days, twice a day. So those are the three big ones. And then obviously supportive care, oxygen, you know, proning, flipping people on their bellies, is supposed to be helpful for lung recruitment. And that's basically the big stuff.
I see. Okay, excellent. Now, I'd like to transition into talking about the government's response. It's one could say that it's been rather varied from state to state. I just wanted to understand your perspective on the federal government's and our own state government's response to the pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to look retrospectively and to give my opinion too. So up front, I think it was so super reasonable to have each individual governor to help guide their own state, because some states, I'm sure Montana is not getting nearly as much as a densely populated New York, which makes logical sense to push yeah. more for closure in the one versus the other. So to have a federal mandate seemed a little bit harsh. Now, so doing the individual ones, I mean, it's you know, I think that's tricky, because every governor won. I think they had a lot of pressure on them, and so no one wants to shut down the government. And the same token, you also will get criticized if you do. And so I don't know if what the right or wrong thing is. I will say there's certain countries that had gone about it the opposite, like Sweden, for instance, who didn't shut a thing down and now have relatively high rates. Whereas the opposite, New Zealand, who has, you know, almost, I mean, they still have a couple dozen, but, you know, markedly fewer, because there was a quick mandatory, everybody shut down for 4 solid weeks, everybody stay quarantined unless you're absolutely essential worker, and then in hopes of, like, just completely shutting it out. So I do think, retrospectively, that probably would have been the best thing. It prevents, you know, all this travel and such, and just kind of nips it, but I don't know, ultimately, if that, you know, would have actually done as well as New Zealand, for instance.
I see. Okay. So my last question would be, what will a post-quarantine society look like?
Well, that's interesting. I think now people are a little in a step back. I think a lot more people will be working from home in general. They're already doing so, and I think that's going to have to that will continue. Thing that people realize that they can get just as much done at home, and so it's fewer people out. I think the mask thing, if it's not, I mean, there's different states and locations that you get fined a pretty hefty fine for not wearing a mask in public. So I don't know if there's going to be fines, but I do think that the mask in public is going to be a much bigger norm. I mean, it's interesting to think about, though. I know there's the Spanish flu discussion. That didn't last forever. You know, we're still not wearing masks because of that. But I do think that the masks will be continued for some time. And I also think a lot of the kids going to private schools are going to be, it's going to be higher. I think the attendance is higher because of the extreme amount of closures and from the public school perspective, and the private schools are doing their best not to do such a blanket statement because of one school having too many cases. So I think there are going to be more private schools that are full. And then I think just in general, things like people are going to do more online shopping and trying to stay home more. I think fewer seniors are going to get out. We still talk to seniors that come into the hospital and say, I can't have COVID. I've been quarantined since February, which has to be really hard on them for sure. Yes. But I think that's going to be big too. People just staying home more.
I see. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Coker. I really appreciate your time. I know it's really valuable, and so I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay. And to those of you listening, please make sure to stay tuned. This will not be the last of the interview, so thank you, and have a good day.